Finance and Revenue is open. We're up here with a depleted committee for a while, but we're going to charge forward and open up a work session on Senate Bill 28. I'd like to do that, then go to 845 and then 164. We do not have all the necessary paperwork for 28 and 164, so there won't be any votes on those today. But we do have some new amendments, and we want to refresh our memories on where things are with Chris Allenack on Senate Bill 28. Go ahead, Tim.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. To set the stage, Senate Bill 28 is the bill that would change the apportionment approach for intangibles and services. It would move the state from a cost-to-performance approach to a market-based approach. And to that end, we have the Dash 8 and the Dash 9, and there is one difference between the two. But for context here, for all of the businesses that deal with intangibles and services, a statute is set up two different ways. They're broken into two different groups. Financial institutions are apportioned via one statute, and it's actually all spelled out in rule. The Department of Revenue many years ago was given rulemaking authority to set up a market-based apportioning for financial institutions, and that's done in rule through one statute. For all other intangible service businesses, we've been on the cost performance method, and that's in a different set of statutes. So what the main part of the Dash 8 and the Dash 9 do is for the non-financial institutions moves all other businesses, intangibles and services, from cost or performance to market-based apportionment. Now, we've been going back and forth about certain concerns by financial institutions or banks and concerns by the Department of Revenue. And so we have a Dash 8 and a Dash 9, and the difference between those two bills, the easiest way is to look at the Dash 8. And on page 2, lines 9 and 10, there's a phrase that says, for a taxpayer other than a financial institution as defined in ORS 314610. That phrase is not in the Dash 9. Otherwise, the two amendments are identical. So what's going on here is that in the rule for financial institutions, there is a tie back to these other provisions. And that seems to be where the banks are concerned. The rule refers to a statute 314665, which gets changed in the amendment. And so the banks are concerned, I believe, I don't want to speak for anybody, but my understanding is that they're concerned about the rule tying back to statute that is being changed in these non-financial statutes. So that's why that one phrase tries to make it clear that the changes in the Dash 8 amendments do not apply to financial institutions. However, with that phrase in here, the Department of Revenue has expressed concerns that there might be significant unintended consequences to having that in the statutes that don't pertain to financial institutions. So we kind of have a circularity here of going back and forth where rule refers to statute that's being changed. So I'm still talking to the various parties, and we're trying to figure out the best way to move forward and if there's a way that everybody can be content with the language. So we have those two versions right now. But the goal is to really keep financial institutions clean with respect to their apportionment in the rule and to not change that, and it's really just to move all of the non-financial institutions from cost of performance to market-based.
Okay, and I appreciate you working on that, Chris, but I don't want to get too hung up on one obscure part of a fairly significant change. We need to address that, but to step back and look at the larger reason for changing. Policy rationale is to make our apportionment or single sales more consistent?
Yes, the state many years ago, we've gone to a single sales factor. So the larger policy that has been made by the legislature is to focus corporate taxation on sales in the state. And under the income tax approach, under the income tax, the way that has been done is the single sales factor. The one outlier to that is the cost of performance, because that does not line up with sales in the state. It's kind of an anachronism in terms of where these sales get allocated. By making the policy change here, we're kind of truing up that policy and being more consistent with the single sales factor policy and establishing taxation within the income tax here to have that all focused on sales made in the state. So this is the last, well, this is a big piece of being more complete and direct with that policy of having the taxes lined up with sales made in the state. So that is the large policy.
Okay, and when we started talking about this, the beginning of session, the revenue impact was found to be indeterminate, but upon digging and more review, there is more of an impact.
Yes, as the last time this was heard, and we had the paperwork, and I talked about the revenue impact. I think within 24 hours of talking about that publicly, I started getting other information. People who were listening sent me some information on estimates made by other states. So I've been working on that information, and I'm still in the process of trying to boil it down to a number that will appear on a revenue impact statement. But we're looking at a positive impact of anywhere. Right now, I'm looking at the neighborhood of a few million dollars a year, possibly, in terms of a revenue impact. So somewhere in the maybe $1 to $5 million a year of a revenue gain by switching from cost to performance to the market-based. And as you may recall, last time I talked about it, there were questions about it being indeterminate. And the theory of how this might work is consistent with a positive revenue impact. I just didn't have anything to tie that to. Since then, I've gotten some information on impacts in other states that gives me something to point to and tie to. And so I'm refining those estimates right now. So right now it's looking like I'll be changing the revenue impact from an indeterminate to a revenue gain.
Okay, very good. Questions of Chris before we call anyone up? We are in a work session. However, I know that there's a team from Amazon here that wants to weigh in on this. And if they would come up now, that'd be great.
Good morning, Chair Haas and members of the committee. Joni Deutsch, Executive Director for the Northwest here for TechNet. Quickly, TechNet represents over 70 of the nation's leading companies in the fields of high-tech manufacturing, computer networking, information technology, clean energy, life sciences, internet media, e-commerce, and the sharing economy sectors. Our members include breakthrough startups and the most storied life-changing technology companies on the planet. We as an industry keep America's innovation economy growing and creating more good-paying jobs. I'm here this morning in support of the Dash 6 amendments, which moves tax apportionment to a market-based sourcing rather than a cost of performance sourcing method. Cost of performance sourcing method results in service revenues being sourced to the jurisdiction where the work that produces the revenue is performed. Therefore, the cost of performance sourcing puts added pressure on in-state companies, particularly those headquartered in-state and those with significant in-state investments, whereas a single sales factor apportionment formula generally coincides with the use of market-based sourcing so as to maintain a corporate tax base. In fact, 21 states and the District of Columbia have adopted a market-based sourcing regime for sourcing services receipts for state corporate income tax apportionment purposes. As you can imagine, in today's high-tech economy, it can be difficult to determine where work is performed when the underlying services are performed by personnel and servers that are located in multiple states. A market-based sourcing methodology reduces complexity by requiring a taxpayer to source service receipts to the location of a customer where the benefit of the service is received. Additionally, by focusing on imposing Oregon's corporate income excise tax base on companies' market in the state rather than focusing on the costs related to performing services in the state, Oregon no longer punishes companies for locating in-state or making substantial investments in-state. So in closing, TechNet supports policies that promote and foster an economic climate that benefits investment and innovation that in turn allows companies to compete, thrive, and expand not only across the country but here in Oregon. A market-based sourcing method reduces complexity and encourages business growth and investment. Thank you.
Thank you.
I may go next and let you close with the specifics. How about that?
Sounds good.
Chair Hassan, members of the committee, Amanda Dalton, I'm here on behalf of CompTIA, the Computing Technology Industry Association, is a membership organization representing the entire continuum of information technology companies, from small IT and software developers to larger equipment manufacturers and communication service providers. I know the committee's done a lot of work on this issue. You may not have seen us, but we've been watching and actively engaged. We did share the Dash 8s with our members last night. They were supportive, including the removal of the throw-out provision from the 6s. I imagine we'll be comfortable with the 9 since it sounds like an amendment not applicable to us, but we appreciate the hard work and consideration of the committee and are here this morning to offer our support.
Thank you, Chair Haas and members of the committee. My name is Damian Hunt, and I'm a senior manager in Amazon's State and Local Tax Group. Amazon is an invested partner here in Oregon with over 700 employees, one corporate office, and an Amazon Web Services cloud computing presence. There are over 40,000 authors, sellers, and developers in Oregon growing their businesses on Amazon products and services. I'm happy to be here today to voice our support for the Dash 8 amendments to Senate Bill 28. Senate Bill 28-8 modifies the way Oregon sources the sale of services and intangible property for Oregon corporate income excise tax purposes, replacing the existing cost of performance regime with a market-based regime. Market-based sourcing generally requires taxpayers to identify where services are delivered or where customers receive the benefit of the services provided and to source related receipts to those locations. Policy reasons for changing to market-based sourcing. First of all, market-based sourcing makes Oregon more competitive from a tax perspective. It does so by creating a level playing field, by treating everyone who participates in the Oregon marketplace the same, whether you are an out-of-state company or an in-state company, receipts are assigned to the state where the customer is located or the benefit is received. Market-based sourcing reduces the likelihood of double taxation that currently exists for Oregon-based companies. 21 states in the District of Columbia have adopted market-based sourcing rules, including Oregon's neighbors to the north and the south. As a result, Oregon companies currently pay tax on services performed in the state where the greater costs are incurred, and then again in market sourcing states where the customer is located. This is not the case for companies in states that have already adopted market-based sourcing. Market-based sourcing encourages Oregon employment and investment, thereby increasing Oregon's tax base. By focusing on imposing Oregon's corporate income excise tax based on a company's market in the state rather than focusing on the costs related to the performance of services in the state, Oregon would no longer disproportionately impact companies for locating in-state or making substantial in-state investment. Market-based sourcing reduces complexity, not entirely, but generally market-based sourcing requires taxpayers to identify where customers receive the benefit of the service provided and to the source related receipts to those locations. Taxpayers face significantly greater administrative burdens in determining cost of performance items. The cost of performance sourcing method requires first identifying relevant transactions and activities associated with each service, and then identifying the geographic locations where the related costs are incurred, often by employees, contractors, and equipment located in multiple states. Finally, market-based sourcing treats Oregon companies more fairly. Market-based sourcing attributes service income among the states where companies do business so that each state is attributed a taxable portion of a business's sales. This more accurately parallels a taxpayer's customer base, which is the historic reason for a sales factor in the apportionment formula. Finally, by way of observation, this would increase Amazon's Oregon corporate income excise tax profile, but the certainty that we receive via enactment of market-based sourcing is worth that to us. So thank you all very much.
I very much appreciate that sentiment, especially what you said there at the end, and you're still supporting this. Amazon must pay state taxes in 50 states.
Yes.
And about 40 of them have this corporate income tax style. And so you do kind of a mix of market-based and performance. Can you give us a sort of a hypothetical of the difference between the two, say, Nebraska and Texas or whatever, of the difficulty or the differences to help us get our brains around the things that the tax issue that companies the size of yours face with this issue?
Well, with cost of performance, there is uncertainty with respect to what type of costs get sucked into the equation. You know, you take a look at the law in Massachusetts, for example, with their cost of performance state, and Oregon, and which is also a cost of performance state. There are cases involving involving taxpayers that come out to completely opposite results in terms of applying their cost of performance rules. With a market-based sourcing approach, you're no longer focusing on costs. You're focusing on the market. And like I said before, it doesn't remove entirely the ambiguity with respect to sourcing, but it limits the areas where that ambiguity exists. So with market-based sourcing, you know, it's the customer or where the benefit of the service is received. And for us, that is a far easier equation to get to. There may be some discussion about where the benefit is ultimately received, but in the end, that discussion is a far more certain conversation than the ambiguities that exist within cost of performance.
Further questions? Senator Boklas. Really appreciate you coming down and your testimony here today. Thank you. We will try to work out the little issue with the financial institutions in another amendment or see if the nines work and take this up again next week.
Is there anyone else that's in the audience that wants to speak or affirm or hold their peace?
The Department of Revenue.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jeff Henderson with the Department of Revenue. And just to add on what was already shared, was wanted to just point out the administrative difficulties with administering the cost performance provisions. What that requires is for each item of income for a company that's doing business, you need to identify the income producing activity. And with the changes in technology in today's economy, that's a difficult task, and it might look different for very similar taxpayers in a similar line of business. So it's very difficult to identify what the income producing activity is. And then once you get to that point, if you have to look to computing the cost performance and identifying what are those direct costs, it's difficult for taxpayers to comply with. It's difficult for the department to administer, and it often is litigated, and those cases can drag out or often just result in settlements. But it is a contentious area. So a change to a market-based approach for sourcing services, it's much more easily to administer. It's where those services will be delivered. So in addition to what's already been shared, it would sync up with how sales of tangible personal property are sourced, where delivered. And again, it would come in line with the state's single sales factor and the thought that in the policy decisions that went into that to encourage development, in-state development. It is much more in line with that. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to question this.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 28, and again, we'll revisit that next week, and go to a work session, open up a work session on Senate Bill 164. We have a new amendment that Chris is going to go through. This is the bill that tries to repair grand bargain of a couple of years ago. Yes, so Mr. Chair, the amendment on the table right now is the Dash 2 amendment. We just got this morning. Mm-hmm. This modifies the policy and focuses it, if you will. And to walk through the amendment, well, conceptually what it does is limits the preferential rates to certain sectors. And it also changes the requirement for the number of employees. And where that occurs in the bill is that on the top of page 3, the number of employees to be eligible for the
number of employees needed to be eligible for the preferential rates is increased from 1 to 10. And then further down on that page, we can see the sectors that the business must operate in to be eligible for the tax rate, preferential rate. And these are basically ag, mining, manufacturing, wholesale trade, transportation, warehousing, information, and accommodation and food services. And the idea here was focused on export sectors. The other change in the bill, and all of these would be effective January 1, 2018, people will also notice that one statute is repealed, 316-044. And as you may recall, when the bill was passed, there was a lot of uncertainty around the revenue impact. So in current law, there is a requirement that I think in 2019, the idea was that LRO would go back and look at the estimated revenue impacts for the first 4 years, compare those to the actual impacts over those 4 years, and depending on how well those synced up, the preferential rates could be changed. But by changing the policy, it affects that approach so that that potential change is no longer needed. Also in OLIS, we have a table for preliminary estimates. And what I put here is under, we have a current law revenue impact that ranges from $239 million revenue loss to up to $302 million revenue loss over the next three biennia. Under the dash 2 of the Senate Bill 164, that revenue impact would be minus $93 million in 17-19. The cost of the program, if you will, the cost of the policy would be $93 million. And that would go to $42 million in 19-21 and then to $48 million in 21-23. So that the bottom line revenue impact of the dash 2 is actually a revenue gain of $146 million in the next biennium and then increases to $235 and $250 million. So basically, the cost of the program is reduced, and that leads to a revenue gain. The usual question that comes up at this point is a three-fifths vote, which is not needed. Our understanding of current interpretation law from Ledge Council is that this would not require a three-fifths because it doesn't change the rate. It basically broadens the base for personal income taxes, if you will. And so there's a revenue gain to the policy.
So the cost of this program with this amendment going forward would be $93 million in 17-19, is that?
That's correct. Now, the revenue impact looks a little strange there, and the reason it's 93 in 17-19 is because that still takes a chunk of the 2017 impact. And the changes here are effective 1-1-18. So moving forward, we're looking at a policy that costs, you know, $40 to $50 million a biennium.
Why not change it to 17 for planning purposes?
We certainly could. The argument, I mean, we're partway through 2017, so yeah. It's certainly your prerogative to have it take effect.
Well, if a mistake was made and unintended consequences are the result, and law firms and cardiologists are the recipients of this, want to add another year of that. Senator Taylor?
I think I agree.
Okay. And we can get a different amendment drafted that would make it effective. And then the impact in 17-19 would be in more, probably the cost of the program would probably be in the neighborhood of $40 million.
Questions of Mr. Alanak on this amendment to 164? Senator Boquist is suspiciously quiet.
We got another amendment coming.
Just for a clarification, so if we were to do nothing, this sunsets, correct?
No, it doesn't sunset. Okay. The one change that is in here we've gotten that question about a sunset, mm-hmm. I think what people are thinking of is that the potential change to the rates that are built in current law. And the policy there was so much uncertainty around the revenue impact that the Assembly built into the deal from 2013 a potential to change those rates. Basically, in 2019, so if we put ourselves in the year 2019, the idea was that the law would be passed and we had the estimated revenue impact that I made mm-hmm. for that time period. Once we get to 2019, we'll have 4 years of actual impact, mm-hmm. or thereabouts. and we would look back and say, okay, well, we thought it was going to cost $125 million a year, but it actually cost, say, $75 million a year or $200 million a year, far, far different from that revenue impact. And in either case, the statutory preferential rates, the 7% and so forth, could be adjusted upward or downward to keep it in line with that original impact. Mm-hmm. But with the dash twos and changing that policy, it kind of, that potential change to the rates is unnecessary, or at least it doesn't really line up with that original intent, in that the revenue, the cost of the program, is, we know it's going to change now. Mm-hmm. So going back, it makes that exercise unnecessary.
And follow up?
Thanks, Chair Haas. So the, and then the requirement that there is some sort of evidence that this is benefiting people, benefiting businesses, creating jobs.
10 jobs.
What's that?
10 jobs. You have to create 10 jobs.
10 jobs in the amendment?
In the dash terms.
In the dash, okay. And that's every year, every biennium, or?
At least every year.
Every year.
You have to have 10 employees.
Add 10 new employees.
No, you don't add 10. You just have to have 10.
I see.
Okay. We'll take another swing at this and maybe have it up next week. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 164. And open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 845. This is largely the distribution and allocation of the marijuana tax. Senator Cruz's bill, and we met several weeks ago to change his bill a bit, and he's fine with the changes we've come up with. But it's more complicated than that, as all things are around here. And Mazen is here. I think I did. Work session is open on Senate Bill 845.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I think it's never too early to do part. So just a quick reminder of what we have here. Remember, Measure 91 in 2014 legalized marijuana, and at the same time, It levied a tax on the flowers and leaves. However, the tax was primarily based on weight and on harvest point. So it was supposed to be $35 an ounce at the point of severance or harvest. Now comes the 2015 session, and it went into just as all or most ballot measures need fixing. The Joint Committee on Marijuana Legalization took that up, and it started writing a few fixes for that. By the end of the session, there was about 262 pages of new law fixing the Measure 91. And one of those fixes also on the taxation side was to fix the taxation type and point of taxation. So it became a point of sale tax of 17% on the sale price of the product. And that was primarily to capture the idea of that the products that are being taxed are not only leaves and flowers, but there are multiple products that are coming to the market, and in order to tax them, we would be able to do it a lot more efficiently if it's based on the price of the or the sale price of the product. So that's what happened. In addition to that, one of the other fixes that happened in the 2015 session was the what is known as the early start, which allowed medical dispensaries to go into selling their excess product and finishing that. And also in the same bill, in that in the Senate bill, it allowed for opt-out of the cities and counties that did not want to and voted with low numbers for Measure 91. So having that, then came the 16 session, the short session, and it allowed for the sale of extracts, products, oils, and so on. So with all of these things that we worked at, remember that a few things came out with other issues that needed to be resolved. And I guess the bill in front of you and the dash six primarily basically addresses six points that needed to be fixed. The first one, which is a direction, a philosophy point, if you will, on the taxation. At Measure 91, at that time, we estimated about $22-23 million a year, or $40 million a biennium. When the point-of-sale tax came, we estimated about $60 million a biennium. And then it seems like things are changing and the money is coming at different and revenue different styles. So this bill, the first or section two in the dash six basically asks the Office of Economic Analysis in the Department of Administrative Services to take up the forecasting process of marijuana revenue and put it in their regular process of forecasting as we have in the general fund forecast. So we suspect that next time, and we've been in contact and consultation with OEA and fiscal office in order to make these things as part of the process that would be presented to you every time there is a revenue forecast release. And we have all the Josh here in case you need to ask any of these questions about this process. However, that is being done, and I think the consultation has to be done with the Department of Revenue and OLCC providing information and so on. So this basically harmonizes the marijuana revenue with the rest of our revenue stream, although it is not general fund, but it is fund that is going to have effective transfers to education and mental health and so on. So that's the first issue that the dash six addresses. The three other issues that comes up and the dash six have to do with the distributions to cities and counties. As I mentioned in the process of fixing Measure 91, remember there was the opt-out provisions, and in the same time with the opt-out provisions came the issue of if a county or a city opts out, they probably are not expecting to get back any of the marijuana revenue that comes through the door. So one of the things that the 15 session did is said if you opt out, you don't get the distribution. However, this created an issue is how do you distribute this? And the issue is, well, there were three issues that came up, and this bill solves them. But the first one that came up is what if what do you do? And the idea was to do it based on licenses that you have in your locality. However, the issue came up quickly is what if you did not opt out, but but nobody applied for a license to be in your locality? Why is it punishment, if you will, for that? So this amendment solves this issue, and it solves it in a way that says if you opt, I mean, for the counties, we have this 10% that goes to the counties. 50% will be based on canopy size, and canopy size is the production, because counties seem to be a lot more concerned with the production sites. And the other 50% is based on the population. So it doesn't matter whether you actually have production sites in your counties or not, but it will be geared more or weighted more towards the production site counties. And for the cities, the 25% would be based on the licenses held in your city, and 75% based on your population in your county. So that solves that issue, and the cities and counties were all, we were in discussions and trying to solve all these intricate details for a very long time, and it's probably just as long as the transportation package.
Only we're closer on this one.
So all of the cities and counties are here to, in case you need to be assured of their agreement to all of these the solutions that you have in front of you. And then there are two more issues. One is before the the changes in the 15 and 16 session, there was the time when there was no licenses and no other basis to distribute the money on. And the assumption was, is because we don't know this early period before all the regime of distribution and sale establishes, everybody should get it as Measure 91 intended, which is based on population. So the first segment of the revenue that comes in before all that is established should go on that basis. And that was always the assumption. And in the last section of the bill, as you would see on last few sections, the section 6 basically takes care of that, saying all the money that came in before the end of the biennium, this biennium, the current biennium that we're in, and after you pay back the OLCC for the loans that they got from the liquor fund and the other costs that the Department of Revenue had to incur to collect, after all of that is done, you distribute based on the old formula, based on the population distribution for the cities and counties. So that's the second issue. And the third one was having the difficulty with, well, if this does not go in effect at this time, by the time it we are in, we might have the problem of the second formula kicking in. So this makes the bill effective immediately and says all that money that comes in before July 1st, 2017, goes back on the population formulas for the cities and counties. Now, those are the third issues for the cities and counties. And then the fifth issue that this deals with is your policy direction of changing the direction of the distribution. This is when the 40% that came in Measure 91 and carried on from the 15 and 16 sessions that sent 40% to the Common School Fund. And as you all know, and maybe others that are not familiar with the Common School Fund, is works as an endowment type of fund where the money goes and just gains interest and does not necessarily get distributed immediately to education. So your policy direction was to change that distribution to make that into the state school fund, but at 30% rather than 40, and then you have 10% going to the community college support fund. So it's still education, but it is at 10% and 30%, and then you retain the 5% going to the OHA, and 15% going to the state police, and then 10% going to the mental health programs. So these are the policy, the distribution policies that the permanent committee kind of does that. And then we have one of the things that we bumped against is that as we in the committee on revenue likes to distribute and have this policy very precise in the distribution. However, our colleagues in Ways and Means and they like things to be a lot more flexible, so we try to find a language in the middle that, that says these are the things that we mean to fund. However, we allow for the flexibility of moving things, especially in the state school fund, college, the college support fund. And this language that you would see that has the for the purpose of used solely for the purpose related to alcohol, drug, and abuse prevention, and so on. So each one of those have very distinct statement of where the money should be. And then, of course, at the end, also we mentioned that all this money is not in lieu of what exists today. So meaning is just because you get this money doesn't mean you get deducted the other allocation that you have, but it is actually in addition of. So that at least maintains the policy direction that you wanted for this money to go, and solves that issue. Now,
Chair Hess, can I?
Senator Taylor.
Yeah, can I just ask a question? So for the distribution for the Common School Fund, for the counties that opted out from selling the marijuana, the they still receive their apportionment of the Common School Fund?
The apportionment for the state school fund?
Yeah.
And, yes.
Right. So it's not that they don't get anything. It's just that they don't get certain revenue streams, but they do get the money for the Common School Fund?
That is correct. They don't get the direct distribution out of the bill. That is 10% cities, 10% counties. But if their schools will get distributions the same way other schools get distributions from the state school.
Follow up? Thank you, Chair Hess. So the rest of the state police, the everything, obviously health authority, any of the services going there, it would continue. It's just those areas. And then the other question I had, Senator Hess, if I may, is that we're about today on the Senate floor pass Senate Bill 1057A off the floor, and there are several changes in the bill that's coming out of the Senate today, and I was just wondering if somebody had made certain that this bill here that we're looking at, 845, coincided appropriately with the bill that we're passing out of the Senate today, with all the changes to the marijuana program.
Yes, Senator, we have worked with the Joint Committee. I'm still monitoring their work, and what that bill did is primarily try to merge the enforcement part between the medical and the
right. I'm just saying there's a lot of definitions between the two. I'm just asking if someone has taken the two bills and looked at them and made certain that the appropriate changes, if any, need to occur, because there's quite a few definitions in there.
And yes, we've been working with Legislative Council, and they've been very cognizant that these things don't actually.
Okay.
But because the lucky thing is we're having the council that actually is helping us with that. So we don't have interactions that should not happen. And at the end, of course, before everything goes out to become coded into the ORSs, all the conflicts are checked. And if there is any conflict, there'll be a conflict resolution, just in case.
Thank you.
I just
got a question.
Senator Bertrager.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On this chart here, you have the 15-17. So those numbers wouldn't be accurate because that year's we would be with the old distribution, correct?
The 15-17, Senator Bertrager, the 15-17, this is the amount we expect to come in through the door, and these are the costs and net. Now, the distribution would still be in that way. What the changes in the distributions between the first and the second year, or the first and second formula, is within the cities and counties. So within that 10% that you have there for the cities and counties, the way which counties and which cities get the money is what changes, but not the 10% itself. So this still holds.
Okay.
But the two formulas are particular to the problems that the cities and counties encountered with the opt-out provisions that they took.
Got it. Thank you.
Other questions of Mazen? I guess I'm just struck by the $100 million. If that's just 17% of the sales.
Yes. That's a very popular product.
Mr. Chair,
especially in Amsterdam.
I mean, two observations to jump out in relationship to yours, I suppose, maybe put on the record. And of course, the Dash 6 is sort of a conglomerate of discussions between multiple committees. We just have to be the executor of the policy, so to speak. But there is an Oregon State Police report that's out within the last month that does identify that despite the 17% being $100 million, hypothetically, if you do the mathematics of that versus the sales, the state police still believes there's $2 to $3 billion in illegal sales still coming out of marijuana in the state of Oregon that we have not captured and we haven't enforced. And in that same line, the fear I always have in these programs, which we cannot solve in this committee, and we've never been able to solve, is just state police, for example, in the 21-23, in theory, there would be $16.69 million for the state police. But the problem I always have is, as we saw in ballot measures, is the Joint Ways and Means Committee can use those magic three words, notwithstanding, and simply take that money or do a game of substitution. So it's not really a plus-up to go out and add additional troopers, as an example. In theory, it should be, and in practice, hopefully it is initially, but to hire those troopers to do drug enforcement and try and find that other $2 to $3 billion. But that is always a concern I have, whether it's the community college, state school fund, just the game of substitution that can be played with the three magic words downstairs and Ways and Means. Doesn't mean I'm opposed, and I'm fine with this. I just put on the record that don't count your money until you have it in your hand if you're one of the agencies or schools.
Mm-hmm. Chair Haas?
Senator Taylor.
Thank you. You know, I just also, you know, I support very much that this 20% is going to OHA in order to do the education and the training, but there are a lot of negative consequences that have occurred, especially within the Portland area, of having the marijuana program, of the impact that it's having on youth. And our schools are so underfunded, and teachers having to, you know, grapple with the impact of marijuana now being readily available more than it was before. I think there's been some serious unintended consequences, at least I can say for Southeast Portland, and impacted a lot of people's lives in ways that I don't think were necessarily intentional. But I support the 20% going there, but like with lottery and like with so many other things, we have to then spend a certain amount of money to help those who get into difficult situations. So it's an interesting way in which we're funding, we're trying to generate revenue to pay for things, and then we have to take a portion of it to then help those who struggle with the very thing that we've given them. So it's just kind of an interesting situation that we're in.
Yes, I don't disagree. Voters passed the lottery, though. Voters passed the marijuana measure.
Yep.
Mr. Chair, just one thing to, this is probably off script, but the bill that you talk about, Senator, Bill 175, there are certain things that could be done to tighten up enforcement. This is one of them, the bill that is coming on that you spoke of earlier. What it does, it actually tightens the definitions on who controls and who doesn't. This will have, in our estimates also, when we scored that bill, we gave it a positive revenue impact, because the less you allow for the black market or the gray market in this sense, the more that you force
that into the legal market. There is a problem of others being, that, we estimate there's 2-point-something million ounces per year is the total demand that we think, and we're producing something in the neighborhood of about 3 million or so. But some of that, the more that you have the ability to have the seed-to-sale tracking system, and have the tracking in it, the more control that you would have, things probably will not immediately work out. But if the enforcement system continues and it starts pushing more on this illegal market, you should have a lot less of these negative impacts coming through within the 7 to 10 years. I'd say for example, the OLCC, you would have a lot less teenage drinking because of that enforcement of the 21 years of age because of the legality. That, with time, I suspect that more enforcement authority and so on will allow for these negative impacts to start transitioning out of the system and bringing most of the consumption into the legal market, and also would benefit the revenue picture even more. But that is coming through, and that's why we expect about by down 3 years down the line, this enforcement bill would probably add about $3 million to the revenue of marijuana revenues coming in, just because of the tightening down of the black market.
All right, thank you for that. So that's the allocation formula. As Senator Boko said, we're sort of the facilitator or executor of this bill that's been worked on by a lot of other hands.
Mr. Chair, I move the A6 stated 5-8-17 into 845.
Senator Boquist moves dash 6 into Senate Bill 845. Is there discussion? Objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 845 as amended by the A6 to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist moves Senate Bill 845 to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Bertier.
Yes.
Senator Riley.
Aye.
Senator Taylor.
Aye.
Vice Chair Bogus.
Yes.
Chair Hass.
Hass votes aye. Senate Bill 845 goes to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Senator Cruz and I will co-carry this bill. So that takes us out of that work session and out of our agenda today. Tomorrow we have the Joint Committee meeting at this time. We will meet on Monday. The May forecast is due out on Tuesday. And that's as far as I thought ahead. So
interesting.
Thank you all. We are adjourned. Thank you all. We are adjourned.